Revelation through conversation.
The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
May 26, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. This is the show you were looking for. God help you, but I know that because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it is a Thursday, and it is the second to last broadcast day of the week for the Ocelli Effect, but there's a lot of other stuff going on. Just finished doing the Jack Blood Show, and that was an adventure, and that stuff, if you're hearing this via podcast, it'll be out there in the podcast streams by the time you hear me, for sure. So anyway, it's been a fascinating week. I mean, what are you going to do when I have a Wednesday night where I've got a, do I do this politely? Nah. A cross-dressing MAGA supporter, Lady MAGA USA last night. I mean, what can you say? Okay, Donald Jeffries interviews Sally Kirkland. I get the cross-dressing MAGA supporter. Okay, Tuesday we did a weird spot, and then Christy Aphrodite, and that was good. It's been a fascinating week. Terry Tapp was back, and now I'm really, really happy because I've got Mike Swanson with me in the first hour here from WallStreetWindow.com. Of course, it's not just about Wall Street over there. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. But he's also the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War, which is a book in a planned series on the war, and has some unique takes on it, by the way, so far, and I'm waiting to see the other two volumes along with you. In the second hour, Larry Hancock, the one of my favorite authors of all time, and we're going to discuss a subject, again, not really often called upon for Larry over the past few years, but what the hell, we'll do it different here on a Thursday, so don't worry, the second hour will be just as interesting as the first. And Mike Swanson wasn't with us last week, but I'm so glad he's back. He signals me in a certain way. I won't even tell you where. But he sends me a message and usually tells me, look, I'm definitely going to be on tonight, or I'm not ready to come on tonight, I'm going away, whatever. He'll do something like that to me right before we're going to do the show, like the day of. And he said it to me this time, you know, I'll be there tonight, his typical thing. And I think I responded with, thank God.
Yeah, you did.
I mean, I really, because I've had such a time with people canceling and weird things going on. It's unbelievable. Okay, nobody wants to hear about this, right? Nah. Mike, let's start to talk about the financial world a little bit, because I always got to start there with you, but we can go in any direction you see fit, sir. And as the markets were bouncing around last week, I definitely looked at him and said, of course this is the week I don't have Mike on. Look at this mess. And it's continued to be weird.
That's the word for it. You summed it up.
You know, and that's the thing, is all these predictive... Okay. So I have always said, I'm not an economist, I'm not a financial guy, really, I observe things, I've got my views on it, but the truth is, I never have money to work with, so I'm not in the game, I'm not invested in the stock market, right? I understand some aspects of some businesses and all this, but what I've seen over the past more than a decade is a disconnected reality that just comes and goes, comes in and out. It's almost like somebody being drunk and every once in a while they can sober up for a couple of minutes. And that's how I see the casino market. And yet it's still a high metric. Everybody says, well, look at how the stock market's doing. How are you doing? And meanwhile, the fears of food shortages, the baby food thing, you know, the baby formula thing has gone on here. There's threats of this and that. And the third thing, recalls. Strange things going on out there for people just trying to survive. Your fuel prices are choking you to death. You're getting charged more for your energy in your home. Your rent's going up. Everybody's getting in an economic tizzy. And I turn on some of these, you know, let's talk about what's going on in the world of money on TV and stuff. And you know what I get? Fairy tales. I don't know what's going on. So help me.
one thing... Yeah, the stock market's bad. It's been going down. The economy's bad. In fact, today they came out and revised the first quarter GDP report and said that the economy shrank by 1.3%.
Right.
Now, if this quarter's GDP report is also negative, that means officially we're in a recession. Now, I follow something interesting, and that is the futures markets, and there's a contract out there for real estate prices. Like people gamble on what they think in the futures market real estate prices will do. But
how do they base the wins and losses on that, Mike? I mean, whose numbers really count when they talk about, okay, you know, the real estate prices have gone up so much or they've gone down so much? Whose numbers are the official, you know, okay, that's really the way it is? And,
they have a national figure, and actually it's slowing. Yeah. Real estate home sales are coming down. They're almost as low as they were before the March 2020.
Okay.
No, that's the amount of new homes being built. The prices have come down a little bit, not dramatically, but these futures contracts are interesting because the people are looking at future prices, and you can buy each month just about and buy them quarterly for the next couple years. And they're fairly accurate in their outlook. And what they're forecasting is that the real estate prices will go down a little bit, particularly around the fall and into the spring, and bottom out and then go up by the end of next year. Well, if real estate prices fall at all, I mean, they're not forecasting a crash or something, just a mild, you know, coming down off of these heights.
Right.
But just a pullback at all, a slight pullback, is enough to mean there's a recession would be going on if we're not already in one. You know, when housing prices pull back just a little bit, people that, you know, borrowed a lot of money when they shouldn't have to buy the house or do mortgages that are all interest, people can get underwater, especially if they're speculating in real estate, you know, buying multiple properties and so forth.
Right.
But so this information, just this thing alone, would suggest this is happening. All that said, the financial media, if you turn on today, the stock market went up today, but you know, it can go up a week and then come right back down, or just go up one day and come right back down. Right. That's what it's been doing since New Year's. S&P's down about 20%, and people who are not in the market, such as yourself and a lot of people, frankly, you know, they think, as you were saying, well, this doesn't mean anything when it goes up. It doesn't reflect the world I see and know everyone else is experiencing. So what's the point of this, sort of? But the people in the market, the people invested in the market, you know, these movements mean the world to them, and they want it to go up, and they will believe. Unfortunately, so many of these people, you know, I've been doing this for a very long time,
right?
Since the 90s, and I've seen waves of busts and booms, and but this time it's. One of the differences this time is so many of the people that are actively trading the market now are younger people. They got in with these apps after everything fell, you know, in March 2020. They weren't in on the crash.
Right.
They got in afterwards, and they've never experienced a decline. So, for example, the way they think, I did a Facebook post today, and I took a stock chart and I blacked out the symbol so you couldn't tell what, you know, you didn't know the name of the stock. And this stock is just going straight down. And I said, this is a mystery stock, and I want you to play a game with me. Click, it'll go to my blog post. I just want to ask you, where would you buy the stock? And click. And once you go to the blog post, the actual stock will be revealed to you. Well, the reality is, you know, there's no way to know where the bottom is. And that's what I write in the post. There's just no way to know. No one can predict that. Mm-hmm. And just looking at the chart of the stock going down, you don't know the name of it. You don't know anything. You don't know nothing. There's no way to know. Mm-hmm. And then I talked about some of the, what the earnings of this company is, some of the valuation metrics and so forth. The company is Caesars, the casino company.
Okay.
And the funny thing about that company, we've mentioned it before on your show, it went bankrupt after 2008. Mm-hmm. And the stock was trading in 2008, but when it went bankrupt, it went to zero. It ceased to exist completely. And then they came out of bankruptcy in 2014. So the chart these people are seeing sees 2014, it goes up and it crashes, and 2020 goes up and now it's crashing again. Well, here's what's funny. One person replied on my Facebook post and said, I would buy at zero. Well, they probably went and read the article, or maybe they knew what it was by looking at it. But one person said, if you believe in the stock, you must buy it. You just buy it every week, buy more. And that person, I know him, he's got into crypto.
Right.
And he got into stock trading, you know, after the crash, and got in a year ago was buying, you know, posting about. He's one of these people that was posting screenshots of his accounts, you know, doing options trades, buying GameStop, buying and believing all this stuff. And that's the thinking process that, you know, these people have. And two other people, an example is something that I never saw before in all my years of trading, and didn't really see it until the GameStop stuff and reading about that. But there was a phrase I heard back then that I never heard of before called financial nihilism. And what it is people out there make the argument that, okay, I got my account, and if it doesn't go up the way I want it to, and it goes down, oh well, that's just life is bad, and it's like, you know, oh well, it's pointless for me to sell because if it goes down, here's what they're thinking.
Okay,
I got this brokerage account, I got X amount of money in it. If it goes up, I can get rich. If it goes down, I'll be wiped out. But who cares? Because I'm not rich anyway.
Well, okay. Now this again makes me feel like going to the casino, right? Because,
well, that's what the mentality, and it's crazy.
What
it's
does somebody do crazy, when they go to a man. Casino, right? Because they go, all right. A lot of people, Mike, I got to tell you, they go, all right, I've got $50. I'm going to lose or win on this $50, right? And some people will go in and they'll dump it in there, win or lose. If it disappears, they're done. They walk away. They go to the buffet, okay? That's it. Other people will go in there and say, okay, I've got 100 or whatever their limit is. I have no idea. It's been so many years since I did it. But, you know, whether you're playing quarters or nickels or whatever, right, or you're going to a table, they sit there and they set a limit. Then comes the next move where most people start to dump more money into it. And in the casino, what's the big rule, right? The house always wins. So eventually you play long enough, the house will take your money back. Now, I see people that recognize this as a casino and still don't necessarily recognize that the house generally wins. And
you're out of touch of reality.
I am?
No, they are.
Oh, okay. See, but that's what I see is on a long enough, on a long enough timeline, you're guaranteed to lose your money. Now, if you move it around, you could maybe, you know, instead of playing craps, you go to the blackjack table, you go to the quarter slots, and it may change how your money moves. But you stay there for 3, 4, 5 days, you know, your money's going to be gone. I mean, almost any amount that you walk in with. And that's the quick way to go, right? So the stock market is a slower burn casino to me. I mean, that may not be right because, you know, people say, well, that's how people invest in businesses. But they don't, because you and I have gone over this so many times where you got a company that's got literally nothing to it. Okay, they're not making money, and yet the value of their stock is as if that every little piece of that company is gold.
That's what's been happening over the past couple of years, but yeah. that's not normal. That's not normally how the stock market works, but okay. It became such a big bubble that's what it became.
Well, but see, now some people would say the weirdness. All right, it was the middle of the night, either last night or the night before. I don't know. I haven't slept too well lately, but I'm looking at it. You know how they tell you in the middle of the night, okay, the Asian markets closed this way.
Right.
We're only an hour or two from, you know, like you're up at 4, 3 o'clock in the morning. We're an hour or two, three away from, you know, our market opening up in the U.S. And here's what they did overnight over there, right? Because their day's already finished. Ours hasn't begun yet, and it's usually an indicator of how it is we're going to open. And then they come up with opening numbers, and I go, all right. And that is almost the most useless piece of information. Because what I saw either last night or the night before, and again, my memory might be fuzzy, is they were going, you know, we don't know how to read this because the markets, some of them went up, some of them went down. And I said to myself, isn't that strange? Because isn't it usually there's a trend and it starts over there, comes over here, big influence from over here, goes back over there, you know, as the world turns, Mike. Or again, maybe I'm just ignorant, right? Everything is breaking. It's like nothing is actually sensibly connected to the reality anymore. When it comes to speculation, when it comes to commodities, when it comes to, I mean, really, I've been over this with you too about the gas price and the fuel prices. There's literally no rhyme or reason for half of the movements I've seen, except that it's moving. And, you know, people say, well, it's because, you know, market pressures and the reality. And it's not the reality. It is driving the reality, but it's not being driven by the reality. And this seems to be across the board now. I would lose my mind if this is had anything to do with how I make a living. And then you got to add in these guys with Robinhood and stuff like that, Mike, right? Which is so randomized. I how do you even track that? I mean, I'm sure the people that, you know, run the Robinhood app know what's going on with them. But what kind of a market force are they? Are they a market force? Are they changing the game?
No, they thought they were.
They thought they were. Right, okay.
Yeah, you know, 14 months ago, but they're getting their head handed to them. So what's happening to them is they're being eliminated. A few weeks ago, Robinhood reported earnings, and they came out and they revealed that 11% of their traders are no longer trading. They've essentially been wiped out.
Right.
And that's what happens in a bear market, which we're in. You know, the stock market's been falling, and these people are just, you know, buying more, doubling down. What's happened is the ones that engaged in the most risky behaviors got wiped out first. It's just a slow process, but I believe that this could go on for quite some time.
Right.
Could go on a whole year, and there'll be hardly any of them left.
Well, see, does that speak to the resources of the people that are actually the big, significant players? I mean, does it speak to that because they can afford to absorb this? It's like, yeah, I'm losing $100,000. I'm losing $200,000. It's all right. It'll rebound. I mean, I can't put that together to lose. I can't get a loan for it. Some of these people were working off of loans at a certain point. I think they put a stop to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that was the other thing is, you know, you could mortgage this against that and the third thing. And by the time it all blows up, it was like dominoes watching it fall down, right?
And yeah, it's insane.
And of course, before you even got into the game was the age of the junk bond, where it was like, yeah, I'm going to sell 800% of a company. Oh, great. You know, like, how do you sell 800? Can I sell 800% of everything I own? Because if I can do that, I can make a living. You know, I'm just saying, very almost gangsterish the way that was being done, except, you know, nobody's twisting anybody's arm and they lose the money. And, well, it's usually somebody else's. I just I don't understand how this is functioning at this point and how it is that people are still looking at it as like an indicator of the real world. Because to me, it's so far from connected. I mean, indeed, when the market crashes, it has a real world effect. I know that when it really seriously takes a vicious hit, the real world sees it, feels it, and shakes. But, you know, when it dips and runs up and everything else, I mean, is it an example of what actually goes on? I mean, I know I've been asking you this question now for, what, 7 years? it's the same question, though. What is going on with this? How do you wrap your mind around it? And what can we do with it at this point if we're not invested in the market? Is it a warning sign what's going on now? Does it indicate something that is coming? Or is it just, you know, your guess is as good as mine, Mike? I mean,
well, it went up crazy. Just like it did in 1999, because the Federal Reserve took interest rates all the way down to zero, and then they did this bond buying operation starting in March 2020.
Right.
And all this, you know, capital went into the financial markets, and people got this stimulus money and got in the game too without knowing what they're doing. And they got in over their head, and some of them, you know, did more risky things than others, and those people are the ones blowing up first.
Right.
You know, people that would open up an account and, as you were saying, borrow money to buy more stocks or put everything in options trading without knowing what they're doing. Right. And most of these people don't know what they're doing, and they still don't know what they're doing. But well, I want to point out something that I read today. One problem is with the media,
yeah,
the financial media, is there's a headline I'm looking at on CNBC, and I'm not trying to, everyone knows who Jim Cramer is, but right. So I'm just going to bring him up, but I want to talk about someone else that's more interesting at the moment. But there's a headline: Jim Cramer, why NVIDIA's Lazarus like rise could signal a change in this jittery market. Well, what happened was NVIDIA is a company, its stock had, they had bad earnings yesterday. The stock went down about 10%, but then managed to be up today. It opened down about 10%,
okay.
It went up. So this headline on this website says, could this signal a change to the market? So the market's been falling, you know, and jittery, so to speak. And here's this headline with Jim Cramer's name on it, reassuring people not to worry when they should be worried more than ever. But no, don't worry. And what happens is, on one hand, the financial media has to feed these people what they want to hear.
Right.
Or else they will tune out or get angry even. So in this this past couple years, on this move up in the, you know, Jim Cramer got big around 2007, 2008. That was his peak of popularity. He got big over that, over really almost a 10-year period, but those couple years around 2007, that was his peak of popularity. 2007, 2008, 100,000 people a night were watching his show, his Mad Money show. And then the bear market came and the stock market crashed, and he became a joke on one of the comedy shows, and people vilified him. And his audience collapsed to the point where they no longer even reported what the numbers were anymore. They fell below 10,000. But he's still on there, and he's still, and I'm saying these things, I'm not trying to signal him, I'm not trying to vilify him at all, actually. Just, but
well, now he does weird things like constantly brings up Wendy's hamburgers, you know.
And he's stuff trying like, to, and that he's in a trap.
Yeah.
That's why I don't want to vilify him as a person. He's in a trap. He has to be on TV every single night,
right,
and entertain people and tell people something meaningful about the stock market when almost every when most days there's really nothing important even to talk about. Well, but he has to pretend there is.
Well, yeah, because not every day.
He has to hold these people's hand and feed them what they want to hear while at the same time trying to help them. And those two things can be contradictory. And he can get caught up. He does drugs.
Okay.
And he can get caught up in, I mean, not like he's not doing illegal drugs, but he does psychiatric medicine for mood swings. And I don't know the exact.
No, I got you, but that I totally believe, though, because based on
sometimes the beds cross up and you can see him on the show not being right. And it's a sad sight.
Okay.
He's putting himself under all that pressure.
Well, okay. Now that's one thing. But the other thing is that it's kind of funny to me because, look, every night you got to try and deal with that audience. Well, every night there might not be something to report because some things happen gradually and some things are not even understood, right? Not every day does the market crash. Not every day does it experience, you know, record highs and all that. So some days you got to kind of go, well, the market was okay today and it'll be okay tomorrow. It was okay yesterday. Good night, everybody. I mean, you can't fill a half hour with that.
He's on for an hour. That's what even makes it worse.
Yeah, but when you adjust for commercials, all right. But when you adjust for their commercials and whatnot, yeah, I'm sure it's more like 40 minutes. But okay, let's split the baby and call it 45 minutes. All right. Either way, he's on for 45 minutes where he's got to be on screen doing something. Okay, he's got a little bit of padding because they could probably play a little pre-recorded, whatever. Here's footage of the market. Hey, this is what the market closed at. You can read those numbers. Every single day it changes. You got something new to report. But unless the trends have actually changed, unless the character of the market has actually changed, what does this guy have to do? He's kind of very limited in what it is he can work with. Now, there's that, but there's also, again, like I said, you know, I don't want to watch him, so I don't. And I have no reason to watch him in my mind, except when I see reports elsewhere that he's, like, doing weird stuff on TV. Then I go and I check and see if that's actually what he's doing, because you would think the financial guy might be a little calmer about stuff. And they bring in other people to help him, too. He used to be, like, just the only guy on there, right? But now a lot of other people come on to help him, seems like. Maybe I'm misreading this again.
I'm not sure. I haven't actually watched it in a year or so.
Okay. Well, it's just I started seeing that he's like kind of some of those times I was thinking when you said about the medication kind of turning on him. I see him kind of, you know, kind of sacked
out.
Well,
I'm getting that. Somebody wrote a book years ago that worked for him and said that Trading with the Enemy was the title of the book, and that's where I'm getting that from. So
it's a good thing I don't have a staff. All right. Anyway, you know, imagine that, Mike. Here we go. You know, the 10. Okay, I'm not going to do that. But I'm just saying out loud. I'm glad I don't have a staff for one of these reasons, because you know, I get real successful one day by accident. Somebody will write a book, you know, probably tell some lies about me and some truths about me, and I'm not sure which will be worse. You know, at least I won't be Johnny Depp. Anyways, it's a weird world. Mike, I got to say, though, that the pressures that they're describing, right, and all the excuses for, well, you know, the market is trading this way and that way. Remember I said I catch this thing in the middle of the night, and they say, okay, so the market's overseas, closed this way, right? The you know, this is the only reason why,
well,
I know phrases like the Nikkei. And,
so,
yeah.
A few weeks ago, I was playing poker in a casino, right? And this fellow was sitting next to me, and he was young, like 30 or something. And the stock market was falling bad that day. Mm-hmm. And someone at the table brought it up. And this fellow that was sitting next to me, he said, well, It had gone up a whole lot the day before, and the Federal Reserve had a meeting, okay, and raised interest rates, and it went up a whole lot. and like the Dow was up 900 or something like that.
Right.
And all the headlines said that it went up because of the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And now the next day it gave up all that. So now it's down like 900 and all the headlines are blaming the Federal Reserve for it. and that's what the kid, and I knew that's what was happening. And this kid was saying that and saying it doesn't make any sense. What's moving the market? Kind of like what you're saying, right?
Well, I've heard the same exact people. Right? They talked about this, what is it, 0.75 increase is possible in the next...
Yeah, that was when this happened.
Well, the funny thing is...
16th of last month, I think it was.
They bring on these financial talking heads onto like regular news channels, and they go, well, this could signal a very significant change in the market. Now, here's the thing. Spoiler alert. You don't know if they're going to tell you that the market's going to go up or down based on the very same principle. And you'll get different results from these guys who will just show up and go,
well,
that's right.
What I told the fellow was, I said, look, man, the day-to-day move means nothing, but they have to attribute it to something in order to report on it, and that's all that is. It's meaningless. And I told him, I said, what's important is the larger trend of the market, and it's a bear market, and it's going down.
Well, right.
You know, over time now until that's over.
See, and that's
all it is. All this is just noise.
And the thing is, it's not a complete departure into total fiction, because we also saw over the past couple of days, and look, I'm not going to linger on this long, but you know, every time there's a mass shooting, what happens to the welfare of the gun manufacturers and the ammunition manufacturers? Their stocks go up.
Sure.
You know, and that's been an interesting trend over the past few years, where, you know, again, we had this tragedy in Texas, and I'm not even talking about it right now because it's not appropriate, but believe me, you're going to hear about it from me tomorrow. The deal is, though, that every single time, and I don't care, starting with Sandy Hook, but moving on, every time there's one of these shooting events, there's movement in gun manufacturers. People start to speculate that people are going to buy more guns. Because, you know, and it just like the whole thing we saw when Obama was elected, right? There was a massive spike in speculating about how many guns were going to be sold, and they were right about it. A lot more guns got sold when Obama came into office, right? And, you know, of course, the NRA-type people would tell you, well, that's because people are worried their guns are going to get taken, so they're going out to get them now. And other people would say, well, there's just a general sort of consensus, you know, the population. I mean, during the lockdown, nobody was buying guns because nobody saw anybody, so they weren't nervous about their, you know, their neighbors. So on and so forth. People attribute this all different ways, but I got to tell you, every time there is a headline-grabbing absolute tragedy that involves guns, it seems to me like you really should get right in on the manufacturer stocks, because they always go up. Now, I know that's a sick, twisted thing to say, but seems to be a fact. So sometimes these things are connected to real-world events, but you may not necessarily understand the metric, but you could understand the movement, which is funny because you bring up poker. And how do I equate this to poker? Well, you know, the object with poker, it's not even necessarily about the cards or the hand, right? It's about how you choose to bet. That's the key, isn't it? Because this literally will define how you win or lose, how you carry that bet. And you can bust people out with certain behaviors. If you establish patterns at a table, you can turn them around. And it doesn't even matter what cards you dealt necessarily, long as you can convince other people at the table that you have them beat, you'll chase a lot of people away. You'll do well. I mean, that's one principle, but there's a whole bunch of stuff, you know, about the intricacies and the psychology of betting, right? It's about the bet. It's not necessarily about the actual result or the strength of what it is you got in your hand. So that's why I always see poker as a great analogy when it comes to the markets. What are your thoughts there, Mike?
No, to win at both in the long run, you have to, you know, when you were talking about playing in a casino and you always lose, if you play a slot machine, blackjack, or these games, the only way you can win is if you get up and leave.
Yeah.
You know, you can, if you keep playing, you're going to lose. So the key to that, the stock market, poker, all these sort of things, is actually how you manage the money, you know.
Okay, so I put it as this is how you manage your bets, but really that's watching your money come in and out. So, I mean, that's what it is, and there is a bit of an art to it. Otherwise, you know, people wouldn't build algorithms the way they do. There are still brain trusts there, I guess, in the markets that people do rely on, you know, to get the hints about what it is they need. But fact is, again, it's not necessarily about the real world and the cards that everybody's getting dealt. It is about the management. So you go in at the right time, win or lose for everybody else, and you go out at the right time, you make money. I mean, you know, you and I talked about this even with currency exchange, where it's like, look, you literally did nothing, but because one currency is down against the other one, you get in on that, the currency reinflates. Well, you go back, trade it back out. You made money just for, you know, deciding to call your currency something else. Now your actual value has gone up, right? There are techniques by which it's just about how you shuffle the chips as opposed to what cards you have in your hand. Now, that doesn't mean that you can always work with nothing. But sometimes you can work with nothing in your hand and just bet your way through it. And if, again, you get in and out at the right time, you can be a winner. So, I mean, again, this is my very, very ignorant view of the market, but it seems to be fairly accurate. I don't know. Like I said, just tell me I'm wrong, Mike. It's all right.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot to what you're saying. One thing I want to bring up with you.
Okay.
I'm looking at the time. Like I was talking about Jim Cramer, right?
Right.
Well, he was the guru of the past cycle of the 2000s, and he's just still around. But this time, there are two people that got really big. One of them is this lady, Kathy Wood. And another one, and she runs a fund that trades on the stock market and went up crazy and now it's crashing. And another one is a guy named Meet Kevin.
Okay.
And he's on YouTube. Now, both of them are on YouTube. And both of them became big. So it's interesting, you know. Jim Cramer got big on television. There was a guy before I ever started trading in the early 80s. This guy got big through he had a financial newsletter, and his name is slipping me, but there's a guy really big. All the big market gurus before say 1980 mm-hmm. were in print. So these people got big on YouTube, not television, YouTube, not in print either, not through newsletters, not through magazines, so forth, but YouTube. So in the past couple of years, for new people getting into the market, that's who I'm characterizing the Robinhood people as, their main entry and the way they tried to learn about it was through YouTube. So the Kathy Wood lady, what she did was talk about her stocks and her holdings and would just hype things up. I criticize her all the time in my posts and stuff. I claim that she talked technobabble nonsense, and she still does it. But the other guy is interesting. And there is a story about him today. They interviewed him in the Wall Street Journal and did a podcast and transcribed it. But this guy he's based in California, and his YouTube channel is called Meet Kevin. Now, I never heard of him until after 2020.
Okay.
But before the stock market crash, he'd been on YouTube for several years, and it says he had about 200,000 followers, which is, you know, that's a lot of people for a YouTube channel.
Right.
But what he did was he was a real estate agent, and he talked about real estate and investing in real estate, flipping homes, I guess, this kind of stuff. But he does, you know, a video a day, or at least live videos. Okay. I mean, a guy does constant videos. But he built up this following, you know, 200,000 people, still a lot of people, you know, talking about real estate.
Right.
But when the market crashed in 2020, he then started talking about the stock market, and he started doing it at the exact same time that millions of people also got in the market for the first time through Robinhood.
Okay.
And his following of 200,000 people turned into over 2 million in just 5 months, a 5 month period. So he became one of the biggest stock market gurus of the past couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as the market was going up, he talked, as I said, Kathy Woodward, hyping the stocks up, cheerleading the stock market. This is how you're going to get rich. You know, this is going to empower you. Get on Robinhood. I'm pretty sure he was in the AMC thing, or
okay.
at least talking about it as it happened and cheerleading it.
Right.
He cheerleaded the market. He told people they would get rich in it, and they believed him.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to believe him. Now, what's happened to him is absolutely fascinating. So,
okay.
Towards the end of last year, he did a YouTube video.
Right.
And he said the stock market had topped out, and he's selling his stocks in getting out of the market. And he's just done one, according to what I'm reading here, just a few weeks ago, saying that he believes the economy is going to go in recession, and therefore he's trying to sell his real estate as much as he can, but he's completely out of the stock market. Now, I agree with him about the stock market. I think it's going to go down more. You know, it can rally here, you know, for a couple weeks, a month. I don't care, but I think this is a real bear market that's going to
right.
take time before it's over with and be lower than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened to him is what's interesting. So after he told people that the stock market is just a big bubble and all this stuff, he's getting out of it, his audience began to collapse. And not only did it collapse, but they turned on him. And he's lost over at least 10% of his subscribers. And but this is a rare person. One thing about the market in the financial media and myself, you know, financial media, when I say financial media, people think that means mainstream media, but the so-called alternative media isn't too much different when right. it comes to the financial media. The alternative financial media and the mainstream financial media aren't actually that much different, because all the criticisms I gave of talking about the CNBC headline and Jim Cramer, they apply equally to the alternative financial media. I once had a discussion with somebody about the financial newsletter industry.
Right.
And he told me that there was a financial newsletter company that figured out the best way to make money is to sell a newsletter that's always telling people that the stock market's going up. And then another newsletter to another group of people that's always saying it's going down. Because in the end, what the people that consume this information want is to hear what they want to believe. And if you switch from one narrative to another, your business will collapse. So this is the rare person, this Meet Kevin, who has seen the market change and made a change himself, and told people to do it, and he's now being punished for it. And this is like one out of 100 financial market commentators who would do this. Now, myself, I shut my business down of a subscription newsletter 2 years ago because I knew one day this moment, this type of situation would come. And, you know, I was just done doing it. Didn't want to deal with it anymore. So,
Because you didn't want to go with the model of, listen, if I tell everybody, I mean, it's literally like looking at the Super Bowl and saying, okay, I'm going to tell half of the people I know that I guarantee the AFC team will win, and I'll tell half the people I know the NFC team will win. Well, to half of the people, you are a genius and you're correct.
Right.
So, you know, and you keep doing that as if the Super Bowl was every day, and you make sure you keep your groups separated from one another. Don't switch on them and, you know, tell them different things. And, yeah, somebody's going to look at you after a little while and say, this guy's 100% right. And
yeah, that's how it works. But yeah. There's also another element to why I did it. I mean, two elements. One, I was doing it for so long. I haven't completely done it yet. It's going to take more time. But I want to change the website into a more generalized news website. I'm doing local news stuff, and that's a whole other conversation. But another reason, too, is that the financial subscription newsletter industry is going to also collapse.
Well, at some point, I'm hoping that you'll actually be able to come on the show and talk about what we talked about privately not too long ago. Because it is
that laptop story,
that yes, that whole thing, because it is hilarious to me and absolutely fits with the thing that I constantly repeat, which is, you know, no matter where you go, everybody's corrupt. And it's like I'm not going to give anything away, Mike, but I'm just going to say that you, as somebody who got involved in local politics and news, found out that that's absolutely certain. That there is just, you had nowhere to turn where anybody had their hands clean, seemed like. So that's how I see the world already. So, you know, your news site, if you develop it that way, it's going to be ready made for me. there you go. Look, a lot of people realize, and it's an entertainment principle, right, that you've always got to give the audience what it is they expected, what it is that wanted in the first place.
Right.
Like, it's got nothing to do with your talent. They came to see a singer. You better make sure a singer is there, okay? You're supposed to sing sad songs. Well, who wants to go and listen to sad songs? Some people do. If that's what it is that they're expecting, give the audience what they want. And if you don't, they will go somewhere else, right? So the thing is that news or information, which is supposed to be, you know, useful, actionable intelligence one way or another, either with the way you navigate the world or understand what's going on or handle the financial markets, the same principle prevails. If people are in the mindset of doom and gloom, what do? We talked about this various times. You tell them, buy gold, buy silver, everything's going to collapse. And by next year, there won't be dollars anymore. You better have gold bars. And you can sell your gold bars to people that think that that's going to happen. And then the next year when it doesn't, you just rerun the commercial anyway.
Or you tell them the reason it didn't go up is because it was manipulation.
There was manipulation, but it's going to happen anyway. So you just keep rephrasing it. I mean, it is very similar to the doomsday preacher who goes, well, you know, we were spared at the last minute. God changed his mind. But don't worry, the world's still coming to an end. The date just moved. And that's what they do. And I know that's uncomfortable for some people. But historically,
they all do it. That's what the bulls do too. The market's falling, and it'll bottom tomorrow. So you got to keep holding.
Yeah, so you hold because it's going to go up. It's going to go up. It's going to go to new record highs. So, and that's what Cramer was doing there until the massive crash happened, and everybody went, well, can't keep telling me it's sunshine outside, and I go outside and I'm soaked. You know, I'm getting rained on here, Chief.
Well, the reason I'm not I'm being critical of him. I mean, one of myself. I'm not being critical of him, and I am being critical. But I have more sympathy for him because I can tell, or at least I believe from some of the comments he makes, that he actually does care about the people. It's just.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Situation. I'm very sure. Look, and
he has a conscience.
Yeah, he has a conscience, right. Sometimes you hear a politician, they make a serious point about, we need to do this. We need to do something about this. We've definitely heard it over the past few days. We need to do something. We need to do something. They might really mean that, but then what happens is the system tells them, yeah, well, you know, we're not going to make that move very quickly. Everybody is at the mercy of the greater, larger system. And I mean, Kramer is a victim of that because no matter what he's supposed to be as some sort of character that tells you what's going to happen, hey, look, the terrible secret, he doesn't really know. And he can't know because it's impossible for this guy to be right all the time. Even the best of the best, right? I mean, I've even seen you, which I found weird in some of your financial stuff that you used to write, go like, look, I was wrong. I thought that this would have been like this by now. But if you do that too often, maybe that's why you're not, you know, on the top 10 list of people out there that are, you know, you're not Dave Ramsey and company or whatever at this point, right? Because those guys.
Well, no, I mean, I know that the whole, you know, there's yeah. a whole. I mean, there's a whole business of selling newsletters, selling mm-hmm. this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have the good most of the marketing isn't really written by the gurus that
right,
but they have copywriters and teams that you know write all this stuff and pay them more than they. I'm talking about the promotions you typically see on the internet, not necessarily television. But in the ads you see on the internet for a financial newsletter mm-hmm. or book, mm-hmm. you know, that's you buy the book for get the free plus shipping book, and you go buy it, and you're actually also subscribing to a trial to a newsletter.
Right.
That's the general model. Well, I mean, they spend big bucks to create these website pages, script the videos, everything yep. is scripted out. Yep. And, you know, I know people over the years who do this sort of thing for a living. And, you know, I've seen them make presentations on what works and what the number one thing they want from the guru that they're selling is for them to speak with absolute certainty
right.
of what they're saying. You know, the more certain they are, the better it's going to sell.
Well, again, back to those commercials which ran on television, radio, and the internet, right? They would tell you, look, you need to go buy gold, and there's a video on the internet right now that's going to tell you all about what's going to happen this year, right now. You need to go to it and go see it. You go there, and they lead you on for a bit again and tell you, look, you got to buy gold and stuff, and if you want to really see what's going on, here's what we'll do. And they sign you up because you want that special knowledge, right? And it's apparently a marketable program because I've seen it repeated and replicated. But that's the thing, is you're selling the people though what it is they were looking for to begin with, because in a time of uncertainty, you know, you and I have talked about the gold bug thing a lot of times. And I'm not saying I object to it. I absolutely appreciate the idea of you physically own gold or silver. Not a bad idea. Okay, it just never is. Before we end, by the way, something else that happened over the past couple of weeks. I guess cryptocurrency went a little sideways, huh?
Yeah, one of them completely malfunctioned. This Terra coin or something it was mm-hmm. called.
Right.
Went to zero.
Right. I mean, so there's that. There's,
now, apparently, this NFT art market, you can't even sell the stuff anymore.
Well,
just no one's buying any of it. So,
well, I asked you a long time ago, and I've asked several people who wanted to sell me on NFTs, please explain to me how this actually retains any value. And I got one guy that I might be able to bring back on the show. But, I mean, everybody else is kind of like, nobody wants to talk about it now. Because it makes zero sense to me. You know, especially when they're taking stuff that already 100 million people have seen, and then they claim it's got value to it. Now, you know, you can own the only copy of, you know, Charlie Bit My Finger, right? I mean, the viral videos they were selling. And you know, I was like, how does this make any kind of sense? You don't physically have anything. It's not even like the idea of like, okay, here's a piece of art that, you know, cost $2 to make, but because it's by a certain artist, because it is this, that, the third thing, it's now, you know, $3 million. And I know there's plenty of those things hanging on people's walls, you know, that they paid that kind of money for. And you know, like, that makes a little more sense than the NFT thing, though, because how can you even guarantee me that there cannot be exactly this thing somewhere else? You know?
Yeah.
Like, at least with a painting, you go, look, I physically hold a painting in my hand. You know, and I've had it authenticated. It's not a forgery. It's by an artist who's been dead for 100 years. I can get the value of something like that, in a way. Some of the outlandish values I don't understand. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't make some kind of sense to me. But this NFT thing, I don't get it, Mike. I really don't. So, and now you can't really sell the stuff, huh? For a little while, Burger King was offering you some kind of coin. I don't know, burger coin or onion ring coin or BK coin. If you bought a value meal. I wonder how that coin's doing today. Is it good? I mean, if it's good, maybe you can take it back to Burger King and get yourself two Happy Meals.
It's just crazy that they, you know, so many of these bigger companies got in on this. Right. You know, baseball selling NFT cards.
Yeah, yeah. It contains a highlight. It contains a photo that only you will have. NBA is selling. I told you about that too. Matter of fact, a funny thing on this show is I was talking to you about Star Trek, and you were like getting into it. And I said, "Yeah, now there's Star Trek NFTs," and Mike just goes, "I'm never watching any of that again." I just went, "Wow!" Like you're like so, like I don't object to it, but I don't get it, right? But you were just like, "Okay, so I'm never watching Star Trek again." Check. And I was like, "All right." Anyway, Mike, I know I took you in weird directions.
Maybe I'll take that back eventually.
Maybe. Maybe. If they stop selling the NFTs, Mike, you think you might check out Strange New Worlds?
Yeah, they'll give up on it eventually.
Okay. Anyway, anything you want to say while we close out the hour, Mike? Because believe it or not, we've blown through like just about a whole hour trying to unpack the crazy world of the
stock market. I noticed that you said you got Larry Hancock on next.
Yes.
And I associate him, you know, with all the historical research he's done in the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
If it wasn't for that, wouldn't have gotten into the other books he's written.
Right.
But I noticed the other day that Jefferson Morley has a book coming out, I think, about Watergate and Richard Helms and Nixon or something.
Yes.
That should be interesting.
Matter of fact, here's a strange surprise announcement, is that he'll be on this show. In the coming weeks, he'll be on this show actually discussing that book. I'm awaiting a copy. And yeah, I didn't expect it. He contacted me himself. So there was a little thing between him and me a couple of years ago, and then he stopped, you know, interacting with me. But Jefferson Morley will be on the show, and I'm curious to see about this interaction between Dick Helms and Dick Nixon. You know, two dicks, one book. Just saying, it's I don't know what to make of it yet. I haven't read it yet. Have you read it, or have you seen any information?
No, it's supposed to come out next week. I plan on buying it when it does.
Okay, well, I should have a reviewer copy before it comes out, but. I'm awaiting that, and it's definitely an interesting topic and a piece of history that does bear re-examining, because to my opinion, and I wonder what Morley's going to say about it, but to my opinion, I go with the thesis that there may have indeed been a concerted effort to remove Nixon from office And I don't think it was a foreign effort. I think it was a domestic one. Okay. And it isn't the one that everybody thinks it was, that, oh, he was a criminal, he lied. And, yeah, he was also a politician. So, yeah, he was also breathing and on planet Earth. These are givens. But Nixon, I think, actually got treated unfairly, because I don't think he was the major criminal that they made him out to be. I think he just needed to be gotten out of the way. And indeed, this challenge to Dick Helms might have been the impetus for that. What do you think of that, Mike, real quick?
Well, Nixon claimed that he covered up Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he claimed that his cover-ups are not simply protecting him, mm-hmm. but protecting the secrets of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security State.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he claimed to people.
I actually tend to believe him and think that that may have indeed been true, considering he had all those CIA people all over the place, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Anyway, no, we'll hear more about that on upcoming shows, I promise you. And who knows what we'll hear from Mike. Mike, you're going to be with me next week, right?
I think so. We'll see.
All right, I hope so. And I'll tell you, hey, thank God Mike Swanson was on tonight. Again, the author of The War State, Why the Vietnam War, and also the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. And even though we focused heavily on the financial market tonight, that's not the only thing that's at WallStreetWindow.com. So anyway, Mike, thanks for doing this with me, man.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Absolutely. In the next hour, Larry Hancock, and we might get into some rarefied information. The Ocelli Effect will continue after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so...
Yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly...
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, too, because... the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ochelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. And for commentary on the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, we go to Larry Hancock. Just kidding.
All right.
That would be the weirdest thing to do with you, Larry. Weirdest thing possible. What do you think of Johnny Depp, Larry? Do you have... I mean,
a topic I can dig into.
I mean, do you have any views on the woman who allegedly might have defecated in his bed? I mean, is that something you want to talk about, Larry? Probably
not. I only have no views on her. I have no views on that subject, period.
Okay.
Or if I did, no, not even thinking about it.
Good enough. I'm obviously kidding, guys. I'm in that mood. I'm in that kind of mood where I got to be a little subversive, and why not? Larry Hancock is, of course, in all seriousness, the author of a great many books, most of them on my shelf right now. Everything from Creating Chaos to Someone Would Have Talked to, Shadow Warfare, right? Surprise Attack. Some of them co-authored by a guy named Stu Wexler. And so on. And one of the best historical authors, especially when you're talking about the national security state and its behaviors out there, as far as I'm concerned. And we've had to talk about Ukraine a lot. We've had to talk about a lot of things. But I'm going to enjoy actually learning a bit, because one book I didn't mention is called Unidentified. So what would that be? Well, wait a minute. We just had some hearings on what they said were UAPs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. I think that's the right euphemism that is currently in use. I mean, I always knew UFOs, you know, it was kind of a standard thing in science fiction, in various debates about the reality around us. Right? A lot of radio shows, a lot of documentaries, a lot of History Channel taken up with everything from ancient aliens to, which, by the way, I don't necessarily disagree with any of it. I'm not making a joke out of this. I think it's worthy of exploration. And certainly Larry's book, which at first I really was sad it didn't receive a much better response from the more responsible UFO researchers, but it does seem as though there is some later action. And indeed, because Larry has not been on lately, and by the way, I didn't bump Larry or anything, just circumstances came up and it was like, you know, we skipped a show or two and he's back, and I'm really glad you're back, Larry. So thank you. And we didn't get a chance to promote something that is coming up very soon. So Why don't we start with that and then get into some of what may or may not have been revealed or even ignored, or maybe a little bit of both, regarding the hearings on Capitol Hill about this recently. But let's start with this event that's upcoming and make sure we remind people about that so they get a chance to, bask in your wisdom along with a great deal of other people's wisdom regarding this topic. Again, real soon. Larry, go ahead and tell us about that.
Sure. I happen to belong to, and I'm actually a board member of a group called the Scientific Coalition for the Study of UAP Phenomena. It's the focus is entirely scientific, as factual-based as possible. Not that we limit ourselves totally, but more energy is put into actually, you know, studying things like the technology, the result propulsion, the physical aspects. You mentioned UAPs. I think that term has been introduced to kind of broaden the field. I mean, UFOs were unidentified flying objects. You know, it focused on objects, right? Okay, something physical. And over time, a lot of people have become interested in the broader range of phenomena that may be associated with this, whether they're, you know, maybe not just physical objects. Maybe there's something going on with, you know, astronomical or atmospheric phenomena, or and possibly even perceptual issues, you know, psychological, sociological. So the whole field is kind of broadened, and that's why UAP has replaced UFO. Generally speaking, the work I'm doing and the work the group is doing is more object-oriented, I think it's fair to say. And we have a conference coming up. We have an annual conference actually in Huntsville. This year it will be remote and in person, fortunately. And a three-day conference has a list of some of the major people that are involved in actually research on the subject. And that goes all the way from some of the people who have been involved in more recent encounters with UFOs, for example, Navy pilots, to people that are out in the field actually doing research, instrumented data collections. So it's pretty interesting. The timing is good, of course, in conjunction, you know, the congressional hearings have brought some attention to the subject that wasn't there. So we're in a good position for people that are interested to, you know, maybe they haven't been following it for a time, to jump into the conference and really see what's going on now if they haven't been following the subject for some time.
Right. And look, it is a subject which has been batted around, well, you know, I'm sure longer than I've been alive, easily, but it's one of those things that has come and gone in intensity and seriousness. Because we do have this, you know, in recent years, right, the emergence of actual documentation, you know, the old adage that, well, the government doesn't want to tell you anything about this because they're afraid of, and then fill in the blank. That kind of went out the window a little bit with some of these recent disclosures, so to speak, right, where it's like, look, there is an acknowledgement that there may indeed be at least aerial phenomena, right? I'm breaking down what they're saying, that they cannot necessarily ascribe to a particular source. And that admission, it took a while, it seemed like, to really be acceptable to begin with. And we need to deal with this from a realistic perspective because, look, if indeed these are experimental aircraft that are, you know, out there and they're not known by our military and they're over our airspace, it would be a direct national security concern, no matter if they came from, you know, the next nation next door or one, you know, across the ocean or across the galaxy. We got a problem here. If there are vehicles that can do things at will. And of course, you studied some of this phenomena in putting together the book you wrote. But other people have taken it and run with it in different ways over the years, and of course it's fodder for science fiction and stuff like that. But it is an actual serious issue, I think. And of course, I know right away I'm going to get a question in the chat room before too long. about, you know, does this also encompass the stuff that used to come out of the ocean, because that's another issue. Now, I haven't seen the government admit that there's unidentified stuff emerging from the ocean yet, but they catch flights in progress of, well, things, one way or another, that, again, are just remain, for lack of a better term, unidentified. They're not actually known, even in a vague sense, how it is this thing came to be, how it is it has its capabilities. And there's a very practical way to look at this, number one. But then again, you know, you're also going to have to speculate and theorize a bit in order to come up with an explanation. I mean, that's just what happens when you have unknown quantities in any equation, especially if you witness them somehow. Does this make any sense to you, what I'm saying, Larry?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to hang our hat on is this is a subject that, as you say, Chuck, has been around for a long time. I first became involved with it around 1964, which kind of gives you a feel for that, and it have been tracking it, involved in it, joined some groups in the 60s and 70s, did some investigations. But it the only time it really comes to national attention is when there is a more or less sensational incident that hits the media. Right. And if that's not happening, it just kind of stays there as background noise. People see things. One of the fascinating things, the reason that it's come back to national attention and has resulted in actually a new directive from a congressional intelligence group, a directive to the intelligence community to investigate it, is for a long period of time, from around 1970 to for about four decades, after the Air Force withdrew from the examination of UFO reports in 1969-70, there was no mechanism for reporting UFOs to anybody. And literally, you know, no government agency was collecting reports, not even making files on reports. And so the fascinating thing is, around 2004, the Navy began to experience some incidents off both coasts of the U.S., in which naval task groups that were out doing exercises and training began to encounter UFOs. Right. And they did get reported back in through operational channels. They did get there was some attention by the Directorate of Intelligence, but there were no rules, there were no regulations. So the strange thing is, the people that had these sightings and these events were really not put under any kind of seal. There was no classification for reporting. There was no mechanism at all. So after a few years, some videos and some stories began to circulate in the general community because there were no restrictions. And I think that's the fun thing. We wouldn't even know. None of this would have restarted over the last decade if there had actually been a system in place to acquire and control and process reports. But because it wasn't, it got kickstarted again. And there was enough dialogue so that it actually came to attention, the attention of several congresspersons who became interested and forced the issue. And literally, the military didn't respond to it. Congress forced the issue with the military and gave them a directive that could not be ignored, that they investigate and report on what was happening with these contemporary incidents, and were they a threat or not? Was this really a national security issue? Right. And that takes us where we are now. Just like I said, I think it's entertaining because there were, for 40 years, people tried to get congressional inquiries when it was being investigated by the U.S., by the U.S. Air Force, and that never happened. And now, when it was not being investigated, we finally got one.
Well, right. So this leads us up to these hearings that took place that, I got to be honest with you, I thought would have garnered a lot more public attention than they did. But frankly, people that I thought would have been interested hardly knew about it. I mean, I mentioned it on the show, and I had somebody write to me like, you know, what are you talking about? Because they heard it, you know, a little while later, the hearings were concluded, at least from the public standpoint. And, you know, what are you talking about? Well, yeah, they actually had hearings. They brought military people there and asked questions like, well, what is it you were doing about this? And, you know, what do you believe this is? And, you know, a lot of military people going, well, I don't have confirmation as to what it was. So therefore, yeah, I don't know what it was. Very interesting sort of open dialogues. But what do you think people should have been able to take away from that had they been paying it a bit more scrutiny when it was happening? Because, I don't know, it seemed to be a very unique sort of conversation that took place here. You know, there wasn't a lot of political grandstanding. You know, like you see in politically charged stuff, it wasn't like, you know, the Republicans were on the side of, oh, you're a kook, and the Democrats were on the side of, we believe. It wasn't like that at all. It was, I don't know, it just wasn't very fiery.
It was very bipartisan. Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I can send you links. There are a couple of pieces of good coverage. For example, space.com,
okay,
which is obviously, you can kind of see the orientation of the site, did a good view review. NPR did a good review of the conference and who did what at the conference. So there was some news coverage, but I don't think it was actually intentionally managed this way. But what actually came out of the hearing, and by the way, we're talking about a congressional intelligence committee. Okay, right. This is not just any committee. This is a congressional committee that is tasked with threat and warning intelligence. You know, that this should be their concern. So actually it was the right committee. And they called in the Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence.
Right.
They called in an Undersecretary of Defense, and they had some testimony from a Pentagon official from the DOD as well. So they had some people that were in positions that, you know, you would expect they would have taken this seriously since they were being questioned by Congress. But
okay,
the fascinating thing is there was a disconnect. The congresspersons obviously were focused on, is this a national security threat? The people that were giving the testimony responded kind of like, okay, we've had, you know, we started out when you asked us about this a year ago, we had 143 reports. Now we got 400 reports. We can identify some of them. Some of them we don't have enough data. Some of them we have no idea about. And so they started essentially responding to the committee the way the U.S. Air Force had always done it. Let's talk about individual reports. Let's show you a couple of pictures. And it's kind of like, we're not talking about threats. We're talking about UAPs, UFOs. And it kind of led the dialogue away from a real discussion of security and threats to a discussion of UFOs, if it were. And I think that's an old discussion. It's not anything new. As you said, you know, the dialogue is more like, well, I can identify some I don't know. The fascinating thing is there were questions asked about security that didn't get a response. For example, the Navy officer actually testified that there was a large-scale event with a drone swarm. We identified these. We know what they are. There's a drone swarm of a couple of dozen drones that actually approached and engaged with one of our Navy task groups off California, and we tried a variety of things, and none of them worked. You know, they were there, and they just eventually went away, and the congresspersons didn't ask a lot of questions about that. Or perhaps they saved them for the confidential hearing that followed, but you would think that would, you know, if you'd had major headlines the next day saying, you know, Navy ships blitzed by unidentified foreign drones, that might have got some attention,
right.
But it didn't go that direction.
Well, some of that stuff seemed to be calmly diverted because I watched a bit of it on C-SPAN, right? And a couple of times it was, nobody made a big deal out of this either, where, well, you know, we're actually going to have to wait for the other hearing to go into some details here, which it just was sort of like taken as, well, then that means you probably know what was going on, and now you have some rarefied intelligence that maybe the public shouldn't shouldn't get, not necessarily because of you and me, Larry, or anything like that, but you don't want to make it an open source grab for somebody else to let them know what we know about them. And it just seemed like that could be a very practical reason for going, well, you know, we got to wait for the, you know, the closed hearing to discuss that. That happened a couple of times, though, didn't it?
It happened a couple of times. And what didn't happen were the follow-on questions that I would have hoped for the from the committee that would have said, and by the way, has this happened anywhere else? You know, have you had drone swarms like this apparently, or drones, or drone swarms threaten any, you know, other elements of the security infrastructure? You know, have they visited atomic power plants? The answer is yes. Have they operated across the United States itself? Yes. Have they operated near our ICBM fields? The answer would be yes. Those questions weren't asked. So yeah. you want, and actually the one question that was asked was a question of, like, could you tell us about the incidents of UFOs being reported and active around our missile sites? Mm-hmm. And the officer who was testifying at that point in time said, well, I'm sorry, I really don't know anything about that. I'll try to find out. You know, now, you would kind of express some congressional dissatisfaction about the lack of an answer, but the congresspersons were quite nice. It was bipartisan, and it was nice. They didn't really grill anybody. They didn't ask any hard questions. They didn't ask, oh, by the way, you know, who's studying this? Who collects these reports? How many personnel do you have analyzing them? Where do they work? And by the way, you're from the Navy and you're from the Pentagon. Where's the Air Force? Where's NORAD? Where's Homeland Security? You know, there weren't any pointed questions of that sort. As you said, it more drifted into a discussion of UFOs.
Well, I think it's
can
also,
you look at this picture and see what's there? You know, it really didn't go into a pointed intelligence security dialogue.
Well, another sign that it didn't go into a pointed intelligence security dialogue is that they were talking about separate incidents, and they didn't discuss any sort of collaboration, coordination that was apparent in any actions, right? Because that would be something else to consider. Yes, we have several dozen of these incidents, okay, and they are different things, and maybe we understand some, we don't understand others. Okay, you break it down like that, it doesn't sound like very much, but if you said that we simultaneously saw coordinated actions over, you know, great distances from one another that seemed to go on at the same time, nobody bothered to ask that. Did this, you know, was there stuff happening at the same time that appeared to be a coordinated effort, and therefore, you know, that changes the metrics on the threat, though, doesn't it? Because if it's one incident that turns out to be benign, although annoying, or it's something that appears spectacular because it's rare, that's one thing. But if you see a coordination, like, you know, going back to the missile silo question, well, you know, a UFO over a missile silo probably isn't going to make anybody nervous. But if you told me that there were 10 of them on the same day at the same time who did it, well, then you have a coordinated effort to do something. And could you determine what that something was that they were even attempting to do, right? So the questions never got pointed enough, it seemed like to me. They were very, very deliberately kind of, not the kind of questions where if you're the intelligence committee, these are the kind of questions you need to ask as well, right? Is there a coordinated? What was the actual situation where could you determine that there was a mission in play here in the actions that you could observe? I mean, one could say if you look at another army, you can see they're moving, they're causing, they're trying to jam one side or the other, even on the ground, right? You could say these things. Could you see a coordinated effort? Could you see signs that there was that this was happening? I mean, am I right or wrong about that?
Yeah, and I think that, no, you're absolutely right. That essentially that question will be there was no historical context, really, from the questions that were being asked, and certainly not from the answers. For example, there was no question that's sort of like, well, gentlemen, for those incidents that you can't identify, You mentioned that, you know, there's a certain number of them where these things, you know, their performance is totally anomalous.
Right.
You know, they their speed, their acceleration, you know, is that something new? You know, have you seen that before? Is this a new thing? Like a new development from somebody?
Well, I also didn't see correlations.
The answer would be no.
Yeah.
I mean, because the answer would be if you had the context, you would know it's the same thing you saw back in 1850.
Right, and
but
another
that context question wasn't asked.
Yeah, and another thing would be to correlate things. Like, is there some other thing that's going on at the time that appears to increase the frequency of these things happening, right? Which is a fair question. I mean, if let's just say that there is military engagement and there is increased sightings in areas of military engagement, which I've heard rumors about before, right? But if there was some sort of proof where you could say chronologically there was a greater military exercise, or there was actually, you know, live explosives being used, and that's what seemed to attract their attention because they were around a lot more when that happened, or if there were other things that were going on, we were conducting certain tests, we were dealing with the satellites, when we did that they showed up more, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's also that other thing where you got to sort of, again, put all this in context and try to determine if you have an unknown thing, you have its unknown purpose. Well, you might want to try and draw some, you know, at least cursory conclusions about the why, right? So they were attracted to this action. We're flying more planes. These things come over more. We've got more battleships in the water. They fly over us more. Something, right? Where you'd say, well, is there anything else going on that seems to come along with the frequency of this? Is it completely random, the data that we have here, chronologically, right? But no,
yeah,
it was...
What you're really talking around is there are two types of intelligence. One is operational intelligence.
Right.
You know, an operational intelligence is kind of like, in this regard, it's sort of like, okay, I have a UAP incident. Can I identify it? Is it an immediate threat? You know, I generate an op rep report through my command, and then it goes away. Once it goes away, it's no longer an operational issue, you know. It's very situational,
right?
You know, and so before this group was created, you know, that's all that happened. Yeah, there would be UFO reports. We have op rep reports that people have found over the years as fairly consistent, but they weren't treated from kind of what's referred to as threat and warnings intelligence analysis. Nobody collected them. Nobody assigned them to the sort of group that looks at a long-term baseline to look at for patterns, to do pattern recognition, to look at indicators like you were talking about. You know, is there something else that's going on? That kind of intelligence is way up the food chain.
Right.
That kind of intelligence is when the National Security Council actually task the director of national intelligence to study something, and that's a routine thing. Every year there are dozens of subjects that are assigned to these high level strategic analysts to maintain a constant watch on, to do watch list on, you know, to see if something is changing. Is there an emerging threat? That's tasked at the level of the National Security Council. That's not even at all what's going on with this committee. And in fact, nobody asked that question. It's like, well, guys, is there any higher level group that's looking at this long term? No, this committee is more down to the operational. Okay, we're collecting more sightings now than we did a couple of years ago because we weren't even collecting them. And let's give you some percentages, you know. Yes, I'm able to identify this many are, you know, those are radically different levels to talk about the same subject. And
right.
So this was, even though you have senior people and the intelligence committee, the dialogue wasn't at the level of that you're talking about, Jake. It wasn't at the level of national intelligence.
Well, that was the point I wanted to make, because to bring it to a much more terrestrial kind of context, right, you would say that the military, as we well know, will study something like, okay, pick a nation. We'll throw a dart. It doesn't matter. I mean, we could say Russia. We could say North Korea. Let's just call them an adversarial nation, right? So they might be aware, okay, the manufacturer of, say, tanks, and this is theoretical completely, the manufacturer of tanks in, I don't know, North Korea. Let's just go with that one. That's the easiest one, right? Okay. So they're manufacturing tanks in North Korea. They weren't doing that a year ago. So now we see a trend emerging. What does that mean? Does it mean he's getting ready for a parade over there? Or does it mean he's actually getting ready for action? This kind of thing is constantly done. There are studies and games and, you know, looks at past trends, at least supposed to be, in order for them to sort of predict what it is our people need to be prepared for. I mean, this is a standard job in military intelligence, or am I naive?
It is a standard job. You're tasked with looking at a potential adversary. You kind of look at different scenarios. It's like, what could they do that would represent a threat to me? So let's lay out some scenarios. Well, okay, what might I see that would indicate scenario A versus scenario B? And then you just start collecting data. The thing is, you have to collect data, low-level data, open source data, whatever, over a fairly long period of time to look for the kind of changes that you just described, because you're looking at patterns. And that is the way that works. You've got to have a group that's given this task that looks at it for months, for years, to see an indicator emerge that something may happen. Now, they can't guarantee it. They can only report on possibilities and probabilities, but that's not how high-level intelligence, quite frankly, that's how it's called intentions indications analysis. That's used in both military, it's even used in corporate America. When you're looking at your competitors, like, are they going to launch a new brand? Are they going to, you know, what's going on? Are we going to suddenly have competition we didn't have before? Are they moving their manufacturing overseas or someplace else that's gonna change the pricing equation?
Right.
None of this is, it's all standard practice, but it's all, you know, you have to do it for an extended period of time to recognize one of these indications when it shows up. One of the classic examples in books is that during the Korean conflict, everybody was wondering when China might enter the war in Korea. Okay, wait, it's like, and so this is obviously a top priority for threat warning intelligence. Well, one of the groups that were doing it were monitoring Chinese shipping, and particularly Chinese shipping orders. And they're looking, and suddenly they find out that China, as of a certain day, has canceled all of the shipments going through Hong Kong. Aha, what does that mean? Well, guess what? What it means is you're going to war in Korea. Right. You're not going to be shipping things through a British port anymore. You're going to have to move that back to the ports that you control. You're not going to ship through an allied port into the Korean War. And son of a gun, that date was an almost exact predictor of when Chinese troops crossed and started committing themselves to combat in Korea. Sometimes it's little indicators like that that can be the most important, but you won't know it unless you've been looking at it for some time, you know. That's what's really going on, and there are no questions that were asked in this committee. That's why I say it, you know. Obviously, I'm interested in UFOs and UAPs and unconventional objects and totally anomalous performance. But this one really, it wasn't at the level that I would have anticipated. Maybe, you never know. Actually, in all honesty, considering some of these drone swarms and some of the possible threats going on here, I would have almost been more content if it had only been a classified briefing.
Right.
You know, it's like, let's get serious. You know, I know about this. What else is going on with these drones? Are they a real threat? Who's operating them?
Right.
You know, but that's not the way it was played. So I don't think the public hearing was a charade of any sort. I think Congress kind of, The committee kind of caught itself in a trap by asking the Navy to lead the inquiry, mm-hmm. rather than trying to boost this up the chain into the national intelligence community. Because what the Navy did, really, quite frankly, is to go back and look at the reports it's getting from its pilots. Mm. There was not even any talk about where these reports, you know, are you guys getting any from the Air Force? You getting any from the FAA? There was no discussion of that.
Well, and also, it's not like the Army doesn't have planes, right? So you could ask each branch with aerial access, basically, you know, what do you have, right? Because, again, if there's no point of collection for it, and the reason why I keep going back to this, by the way, is because, again, if you have an unknown, you know, an unknown whatever, and you're doing threat assessments on it, and it remains unknown, one would logically say that as an unknown, it must be considered maybe not immediately hostile, but potentially hostile, right? So you have unknowns, you don't know where they came from, you're not certain that they were, you know, again, a benign something, an ally, an experimental craft, whatever, a spy plane, which might not be such a big deal, right? Depending. If you don't know, you don't know. So your threat assessment has to almost begin with the assumption of some level of hostility, one would think. So to me... Well,
and I can give you an example, and you're right, because I would think if it were me, I would really say... Gosh, way up there in the national intelligence community, the subject of adversarial drones ought to be high on the list of threat and warnings intelligence. One of the more extreme things that's come up over the last couple of years is a drone was reported over a major Air Force base in Arizona, mm-hmm. circling the base, operating over the base. Who got called? The police got called. Okay. Huh. The police sent a couple of helicopters. These are pretty high-performance helicopters. They spotted the drone. They imaged the drone on infrared. They could not intercept it, and the drone literally raced them and left them behind in the dust. Well, now, right. From a security standpoint, that's troubling, you know, because you're not just talking about a drone. You're talking about a drone that just... outmaneuvered, outflanked, and outran two police helicopters.
Right.
And obviously this was not discussed, but that was reported to the FAA. We have the tapes. One of the points of discussion that came out of the hearing is that one out of the testimony said that the group, which, right. by the way, the group is the Airborne Object Identification and Management Synchronization Group.
Yeah, trying to remember
that
one.
I'm sure that gives you immense confidence there. Yeah. But they said that they had a goal of working and improving in cooperation with the FAA. So they're already a year into this, and they have a goal of getting working with the FAA. You know, I don't see it as I see it as something, and I'm not trying to be negative, that they got tasked with, and they're trying to do, you know, a job probably with limited personnel and under a, you know, kind of a very not much different than the Air Force program back in the 60s and 70s that maybe had three officers and a secretary assigned to it. You know, I would love to know how many people are assigned to the Airborne Object Identification and group.
Well, that would be a good question, but again, none of the questions seem to be pointed. But I also did not get the sense, just like you didn't, that it was a charade. It just, you know, here we go. A year in, you've got a goal to cooperate with the FAA? I mean, does that... I mean, look, it's not unusual that, you know, well, we're going to study that. And meanwhile, it's already been studied, you know. In a lot of other cases, we find this with government action, right? So I'm not surprised, but I guess I'm a little surprised that there is no significant movement here. Now, is it possible, Larry, here's just an open, again, ignorant question of mine. Is it possible that what we don't know right now, that there's a great deal more going on here, that it is a lot more focused, that it does appear to be more in hand. You know, they were really collecting this, but they collect it in such a place that, yeah, that's the kind of thing that we don't tell the public about. Is it possible that more information could have been made available, and that there is literally, you know, again, the cover-up for our own good going on here, because they don't want to reveal some things that they do know about, things that are significant threats to national security, that may be known quantities that at one time were unknown. I mean, is there a possibility that they're hiding some of their own progress? In other words, so as not to allow open source on some of the stuff that they went to a great deal of trouble to collect. Is that a possibility?
I think that's a possibility, and I think it would happen totally outside this group. I find it difficult to believe. Let's go to the example, not so much of the true UFO or UAP encounters. Okay, we won't talk about the Nimitz incident where Navy jets tried to intercept and engage with UFO operating in conjunction with the fleet and weren't able to do it. We'll talk about that one. Let's talk about something simpler.
Okay.
Let's talk about the drone swarm over the Navy ships off San Diego. I find it hard to believe that that was not... There are a couple of naval intelligence groups,
right,
that would be tasked with dealing with the threat of a drone. I mean, the testimony to the committee... Oh, we know those are drones. There was not any question of identification or non-identification.
Okay.
I would expect that there are a couple of groups inside naval intelligence that are very actively working that subject. They're working, you know, not only to identify where they're from and how they're controlled, but how to deal with them. So at that level of actual concrete identified threats, absolutely, I think it's being worked, and that might have what was be discussed in the classified briefing. I think what's not being discussed anywhere are the unknowns.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to talk about something that's operating at, you know, even a swarm operating at, you know, a couple hundred, 300 miles per hour. It's one thing to talk about that and deal that with that inside intelligence groups. It's another thing to, you know, where do you really send the report of a UAP, that UAP that totally baffled the Navy interceptors? Where would you even put that? Who would look at it? My concept is probably somebody with some smarts is going, you know, that's not the Chinese, it's not the Russians, obviously. It is a true unknown. And since we have nothing that can deal with it, forget it. We'll worry about the threats that we can deal with. You know, I've only got so much resource. What's my priority? I'll prioritize dealing with that drone swarm, and we'll just slide the real UFO, you know, into the files.
Well, if it didn't do any damage.
Since we can't handle it anyway.
Yeah, look, it didn't do any damage. We don't know how to handle it. It's not the priority because... We know that there are things out there that can do damage that we got to keep an eye on. So that's where we're going to direct the resources. I mean, it's just that simple. So look, before we do run out of time, I want to give you a chance to tell us what it is that you think people should take away from those hearings. Ultimately, I mean, you know, kind of a wrap a bow on that for us, Larry, if you wouldn't mind. And also remind people about Unidentified and again about this upcoming conference before we're all out of time.
I think the takeaway is that for those people that are really interested in the true UFO, the true UAP, something that is an object that is behaving totally anomalously, that's not going to be addressed in this effort, just like it wasn't addressed by the Air Force in Project Blue Book. It, just like you said, Chuck, when they closed down that project, the answer was, we've looked at this for 20 years, we found... numbers that we couldn't identify, but we found no sign of hostility or threat. And therefore, you know, we're going back to our real job, which is dealing with, you know, real threats. Dealing with Russia, dealing, you know, okay.
Right.
Same thing going on today. So for those people that are interested in the true UFOs, as it were, I think you're going to have to rely on either academics, the academic community, or professional organizations like SCU, who have members that are willing to devote the time and energy into studying it from a scientific standpoint, or basically an intelligence standpoint, using the techniques that the real professionals in the military structure would use if somebody tasked them with it, but they're not going to get that job.
Right.
So it's going to be up to us to do it. And quite frankly, I'm part of a team right now within SCU who is over 2 years into performing a real intentions threat and warning analysis. And it's a lot of work. So I think that would be my takeaway, is if you're going to look for that kind of study, you're not going to find it being discussed in these committee hearings.
Right.
You may find it being discussed in the work that we're doing. And basically the work I'm doing, I kicked off this sort of approach in Unidentified, the National Intelligence Problem of UFOs, because, you know, I had become familiar with the techniques, and it's like, you know, clearly nobody has been taking this long-term historical pattern-based research to the subject. Well, I'm going to do it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did the book, and that you'll find that in the book, at least at an introductory level.
Right.
But now our group is going further with it. We will be presenting on our work at the conference. We've already been presenting on our research to the SCU membership in stuff that we publish internally. So we have, but it has to be very rigorous. Everything has to be dot the I's, cross the T's, and so it takes a time to make it happen, especially when you don't have the resources of the national intelligence community behind you.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that independent researchers, as per usual, don't necessarily have the resources, but they may take the time to do the work, which means it's going to run a lot slower, and it's going to require things like, you know, having an organization that has memberships and things like that, so that you can fund some of this research, because some of this is going to cost money. You know, you got to collect and verify things and really analyze them, and that takes up a lot of people's time. And, you know, the old adage, time is money. So, again, is there a website that people can go to, though, to still participate?
There is. The SCU has a website. So just go to Scientific Coalition for UFAPs, and you find, I can send the link, and that will tell you about what the group is doing. It'll tell you about the conference. If you join, we do have a newsletter that we publish quarterly, and our team just had an article in it about the intentions analysis that we're doing. And we have found some very, at this point in time, to put it this way, not as a teaser, we have found 10 specific anomalous patterns of UAP activity over the American Atomic Warfare Complex beginning in 1945 through 1975 that very certainly are anomalous, to the extent that you will look at the charts we make and look at the data and go, hey, wait a minute, there is something going on here. Now, boiling it down from that point is even more work. But we're coming up with some pretty solid data to demonstrate that something not atypical was going on, that there was UAP activity demonstrating a very specific interest in the development of atomic weapons.
Right.
And that's pretty interesting.
No, definitely. And that's something that, again, I had heard about for a long time, but only got a solid analysis when I read Unidentified, which, of course, if you go to larry-hancock.com, you can learn about a lot of other stuff that Larry's written. But I tell you that all of his books, depending on the area of interest you really want to focus on, are valuable commodities on my bookshelf, and would be the same for you. So, digital or physical form, I prefer the physicals, but, you know, you can get a lot of his books on Amazon through the Kindle and all that good stuff. And I'll give you links to go get Larry's work along with the show notes. So that is almost the end of Thursday. I might come back for a couple of minutes here after going to a quick break and give you a final thought for the night. And that'll be that. But thank you, Larry Hancock, for joining me. And also, thanks to Mike Swanson for joining me in the first hour. I'll be back in a couple minutes.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
So, just for a final word here on a Thor's Day, as it were, wanted to give you guys the heads up that I seriously appreciate anybody who has contributed to the cause lately, but could definitely certainly use a little bit more help because I'm getting squeezed over here and all that good stuff. Click on the donate button at Ocelli.com. Contact me if you want to do it a different way. That's fine, but definitely could use your help to keep things going. And, just deal with certain things that are emerging. And if things have fallen off, it's tough all over. I know that. So, anyway, there's that. But also, I want to give my final thoughts on tonight. I didn't mean to take Mike all the way through the hour with a whole lot of financial stuff, but that's the way it turned out. And it was really good to have Mike back on, really good to have Larry back on. People have noted some inconsistencies in my guests lately. I assure you it's not through lack of effort on my part. It's just the nature of the beast at the moment. Anyway, who knows? Maybe I'm in need of a break. I know I'm still in need of some more whiskey. So, that's always helpful. I'm not going to drink when I'm on air, but I may need to relax afterwards. So, anyway, there's all that, and I'm looking forward to having Jefferson Morley come on. Dylan Wade will join me at some point. He wasn't quite up to it this week, but I'm going to have him join me after his appearance on the Young Turks. We're going to have John Potash come back on pretty soon. A couple of other films and things that are about to come out, we're going to promote those and get some other return guests. I'm also looking for feedback from you guys about some of the recent JFK guests that have been different, and if you want me to keep doing that or not, I'd like to know. But it is what it is right now. Oh, and on Monday, the Greek will return. So until tomorrow night, yes, the Greek, that guy, will return on Monday. And we're going to do an addendum to all of the Ocelli and the Greek stuff in short order. That's the plan. We'll see how it turns out. And tomorrow night, what is the plan? We're going to go live and take your calls. So hopefully I'll get this podcast out in enough time for you people to realize what's going on. But we'll do 2 hours of calls. Aaron Franz will be back this week. It was interesting to have Bob do a special show with somebody who survived the 44 caliber killer case or the Son of Sam case. That's an interesting show. A lot of that stuff out on podcast. I mean, and the show's gone in weird directions lately. Lady MAGA USA, or Lady MAGA USA, on last night. The what do we call it? Oh, the drag queen, who is a ardent Trump supporter. It's been an interesting time, and I hope that you find it as interesting as the times in which we live, because those are strange. Those are strange, and people are strange, and yeah. so am I, and so are you if you're listening to me. So I appreciate you. I want you to know that, because I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so...
Yeah, that is
the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly...
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, too, because... you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.